kind of introduction. And I want, since most of the group here is are social workers and psychologists, and I know that we also have consumers and families and a few psychiatrists, what I say, I will try and spend a little bit of time talking about the non-medical therapist and maybe how to think about medications. So I'm sure you've all caught the stuff in the paper about psychiatrists, and there was a bit about psychiatrists in Minnesota a couple of years back. So I just thought I'd give you some details. As I said, I'm the scientific editor of the NEABPD scientific website. I receive royalties that might buy me a hot dog at the while I'm waiting in the airport tonight from the American Psychiatric Association, and I hope to be getting some royalties from Cambridge University Press. I'm one of the three co-editors of a new journal called Personality and Mental Health, which is owned by Wiley Blackwell out of London. I have no financial relationships with any pharmaceutical or device company, and since I'm going to be talking about medications and borderline personality disorder, and no medications have been indicated in borderline personality disorder, therefore I will talk about the off-label use of borderline personality disorder. So I thought that since this was the lifespan, BPD over the lifespan, I would try and talk briefly about medications in adolescents and in geriatric or elderly patients. Since I'm getting in the geriatric range, we have to find another label for that. But what I'm going to talk about medications isn't really limited to adolescents with a borderline personality disorder. The medications as a class aren't really as effective, or I might say effective in the same way with adolescents as they are with adults in general. And if you look at the studies with the SSRIs in adolescents, there are very few studies, and I believe that that fluoxetine is really the only SSRI that's been approved for, it has the indication for adolescent treatment of depression. In adolescents, there may be greater risks of heart problems, cardiac problems, on antipsychotics. There's really good evidence that adolescents gain more weight on antipsychotics, and folks who aren't adolescents gain a lot of weight in the first place. There's no data on mood stabilizers in adolescents. It's just beginning, and most of those studies have been pharmaceutical sponsored. And there's a lot of stuff now out there about the treatment of bipolar patients with medications, adolescent bipolar patients, and we can get into a discussion at another time about the fact that borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder are really different disorders. Not that they don't overlap in some people, but that they really are still, at this point in time at least, different. Switching to the other end of the spectrum, older patients break down medications at different, frequently slower rates, and older patients tend to be on more other medications for medical problems and other psychiatric medication, non-psychiatric medications, so there'll be plenty of drug-drug interactions. So you have to kind of think very clearly about what you're doing. There was a terrific series in the New Yorker, I think in April 07, by Atul Gawande on geriatric medicine. If you should, talking about if you're over 80 and you're on more than five or more medications, you have 100% chance of falling. And falling and breaking a hip is one of the leading causes of death in people over 80. So that we need to think very carefully. The benefit-risk ratio changes with age, you might want to think. And then they tend to be more vulnerable to certain side effects of medication. So again, if you have a medication that might cause lowering of blood pressure, that can also really increase an individual's risk of falling, and maybe even their risk of anxiety or agitation. So you've heard Alec and Nikki talked a little bit about this, that certainly there's greater uncertainty as to the diagnosis of BPD, but they talked to you a lot about the fact that there's more data that's showing that BPD is in adolescents a valid diagnosis. But you have to differentiate it from teenage angst and concurrent substance abuse and the fluctuations and uncertainties of life of being an adolescent. And there are no good pharmaceutical studies of borderline personality disorder in adolescence at all. So then what's there to do? But I think that this is the way to go about the pharmacologic treatment of borderline personality disorder across all of the age groups, is to ask oneself, is there an axis 1 disorder also present? And the first question is there an axis 1 disorder present? Not that do they, you know, from 2 to 4 on a Saturday afternoon, they act like they might have an axis 1 disorder because they're being anxious and panicky, but can you really think that is there an axis 1 disorder present? And then to back off, if there isn't, is there a symptom that keeps recurring that would remind you or that was a core symptom in an axis 1 disorder? So in that instance, you might want to empirically think about choosing a medication that would at least address that symptom or symptom complex with respect to the axis 1 disorder. Or has there been a sudden change in clinical presentation, and has that change persisted for more than a few hours or a few days? So I believe it was Anthony who talked about I think not treating, giving people medications in crisis, and maybe you did. I that was a long time ago already. So, but that it's really important. You have to remember that the phrase "the stably unstable" was used with respect to borderline personality disorder. So, with each episode of instability, you can't then decide that you want to make a change. You really need to have some long-term strategy, some long-term idea of what are going to be the particular target symptoms or target areas in your treatment of the patient. Otherwise, you will really be changing patients more rapidly than the patient changes moods. Has there been a previous history? Has there been a history of a good response to medication? Or is there a family history of some mood or anxiety disorder in the family? And have those individuals responded to medication? And if so, then what medication might you want to choose? And then you also have to think about substance misuse. But I think that all of this isn't just with respect to adolescents, but particularly in adolescents, I think that you really need to kind of do your homework. But with some caveats, that the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are useful in treating major depression not related to borderline personality disorder. But again, there's only data for fluoxetine for treating major depression in adolescents. And while it may be useful in treating major depression in adolescents, most studies of drugs, particularly the SSRIs with adolescents, show a higher placebo response in the control group. So the differential between what is a responder or not responder, or are there so many more people responding in the placebo group, that it becomes difficult to really understand what might be a significant finding in the use of a drug. And that may be the reason why there are less SSRIs that have been found to be effective in depression in adolescents. It may be not that they don't work. It may be just that the placebo group is responding so highly, so you can't find enough variance between the two groups. The atypical antipsychotics, again, probably cause more weight gain in adolescents than adult, and there may be some indication that they may cause, besides weight gain, more metabolic abnormalities, such as high cholesterol and perhaps leading into problems that could be diabetic-like. And what we know from the older antipsychotics, that particularly young men, that they have more trouble with the movement disorders when they're given antipsychotic medication. And the longer you use at least the older antipsychotics in women, the more there may be over the years more movement disorders as those people age. So young men, older women. So what do we really do? I think the first thing is you have to ask yourself, is the depression really a depression? You know, depression is an adjective. Depression can describe a transient mood, and we may find out that depression describes an economic state of a country. Is the individual safe with the use of medications? So can you trust the person to take the medication as prescribed, and they're going to be compliant? I often say to people, I don't know whether the medication will work, but I guarantee you 100% that it won't work if you don't take it. And if you're not going to take it, that's really okay with me, but let me know, because I don't want to be thinking about the fact that you're on medication and you're not any better or something when you're really not taking medication. I'd much rather have the truth than to, so we know where we are. And you have to be available to decipher the reactions, the side effects, and the concerns that, that patients have. Because number one is you don't want a patient to take a medication that they're having a side effect for, particularly when they're an adolescent, because then what you're really doing is reassuring the fact that they're not going to want to take medications in the future. But also you don't want them to toss the medications out if they're undergoing some transient side effects, or maybe they just have the flu. Or, you know, or maybe they were out on a 3-day drinking binge and they're you know, attributing the reaction that they're having to the medication. So I believe that you have to be available to these folks. You have to be available weekends. You have to be available evenings. I mean, you have to be available if you really want to work with them. And you have to also know that, you know, adolescents get sexual side effects to the medications, particularly to the SSRIs, and you have to be willing to ask them about that. I am fortunate to be a psychiatric consult to the primary care clinic at University of Michigan. I do that a day and a half a week, so there's 40,000 students there, so I get to see a lot of folks, and we do a lot of SSRIs there, not for BPD. And, you know, you have to ask 18-year-old kids, you have to ask them about, well, you know, these drugs may give you trouble if, you know, with orgasm or things like that. It's always very interesting because some people say, well, you know, I'm not involved with anybody now, you know. And so you say, well, you don't have to be involved with somebody to have an orgasm, you know. And very often when you say that, they will tell you if they are on having trouble with medications. But what Barbara was saying before is you really have to ask these folks. And you know, if you ask them, guess what? They really will tell you. But if you don't ask them, like the medications, then you don't know where you are. In the elderly, I can simply say there's no data. There's very little data with respect to who is a borderline as he or she gets older. I mean, I think that there are clearly people who have been borderline since they were young, and those are easy to identify. But I also think there's a group of kind of closet borderlines that are kind of come in to a unit. They're people in their 60s or 70s. They come in with a lot of anxiety symptoms, a lot of depressive symptoms. And when you treat the depression, even if you treat it with SSRIs, what you find out is it's kind of chronic narcissistic anxiety, pay attention to me, and demandingness that feels very much like your reaction feels very much like your reaction would be in when you're treating with a borderline patient who feels that somehow you're not doing enough for them. There's a lot of somatizing anxiety as well. So, but I'm not really sure about that, and I'm not really sure that that's just not my reaction or overreaction, but there's really been nothing done with respect to the elderly and BPD, and therefore there isn't any data with respect to treating elderly psychopharmacologically. You know, and so there's greater uncertainty. I think, as I said before, anxiety may play a larger role in these folks as they get older, but also there's a lot of life issues. So when we're thinking about the things that that adolescents have to go through with respect to life and how that can confuse what might be a clinical picture. So how do you decipher what might be the day-to-day stresses from the with respect to clinical symptomatology? In elderly adults, there's loss of social support, there's loss of material support, and there's loss of organ support. That, you know, if you're not thinking as well, if you have some deterioration in intellectual or physical well-being, all those things can present people to us with a lot of demands and a lot of anxiety, but they're not people that you would think would be characterological. So the diagnosis here is less certain. If it shows up, it may not be typical, and I think it may show up as more of a state of anxiety rather than in other people maybe as a form of a state of depression. They're physically less firm. There's more drug-drug interactions, but there's no controlled medications. So let's get to the rest of the world. There are no medications that carry a specific indication for the treatment of personality disorders, let alone borderline personality disorder. And one of the things, I was one of the consultants from this country on the NICE guidelines that Anthony was talking about, but I had to give the address of my children that they were going to kidnap my children should I reveal anything about it. But since you've broken the ice, I guess, you know, and they'll get to you faster because you live there and I live here. That one of the things that's that was interesting, because when they analyzed the different kinds of medications, one of the things that they did was they said, does it treat borderline personality disorder, were one of the questions, rather also looking at the various symptoms. And there's no medication that treats borderline personality disorder. I didn't think it was a fair question that they were asking, but I also thought that someone needed to kind of do it and realize that this is really, like any psychiatric disorder, BPD is a syndrome. So the idea that you can give a medication and treat a syndrome, or as Mary talks about, temperamental versus acute symptoms, I mean, because it is a syndrome doesn't mean it's not a valid diagnosis, phenotypically, how we see things clinically, but you're not going to find a medication per se to treat a syndrome. So therefore, we have to use all our medications off-label. And the medications in general, even if you're treating them for those Axis 1 disorders or those symptoms embedded in an Axis 1 disorder, the medications aren't going to be as effective for that disorder or the parts of that disorder in BPD as they would be in people who didn't have BPD. And yet, so that not only on one level are they less responsive, but also people seem to be exquisitely sensitive to the side effects. I mean, with all due respect to people in the audience who are consumers, that sometimes from where we sit as psychiatrists, and this is, you're not alone in this, but is that sometimes when people read the side effects, they get them before the medications ever get into their system. And so we're trying to figure out what to do, and I don't mean that at all as a manipulation. There really does seem to be an exquisite sensitivity to that. And I think we're learning things about psychogenomics, the genetics behind psychopharmacologic genetics that might lead us to understand those things better. But you have to understand so that they're less effective, they cause more side effects. So to make a medication choice for someone with borderline personality disorder based upon a cost-benefit analysis that's been used for non-borderlines, you can't necessarily translate that over because the balance is different. You're having more side effects and getting less therapeutic effects, so that really just changes things. So which of the psycho criteria might be responsive in some way to psychopharmacology? And maybe unstable and interpersonal relationships, the plus minus means maybe, and that may have to do with if people kind of, when stressed, they get paranoid or they have a tendency to be impulsive. So I put a plus minus there because it isn't really addressing that particular criterion, but it may be addressing another symptom or criterion which will then have a secondary impact on, in this instance, interpersonal relationships. It seems to be able to impact impulsivity, certainly the suicidality, but maybe not as much as the impulsivity. There's some decent evidence, but not consistent evidence, about being helpful for affective instability and perhaps anger, and I think stress-related paranoid ideation can be helpful, but does little for abandonment, identity disturbance, emptiness, the kinds of stuff that Mary was talking about with respect to what are the temperamental symptoms. I'm going to skip this. I think Alec talked about how Lenna had kind of reorganized the BPD diagnosis there. So what I'm going to do briefly, and I'm going to do this very, very briefly because I want to get to the how to think about all this, is to look at what have been four or five reviews of medications in borderline personality disorder that have really come out in the last 2 to 3 years. And what you'll find is that each of the reviews finds some medications might be useful for some of the dimensions or criteria for borderline personality disorder. But when you go to the next review, lo and behold, they don't find it, or they find a different medication for that. But I think I just, before I get to the kind of conclusion, I want to at least defend the inconsistency. And each one of the papers concludes with, well, we're not really sure what we can do here, okay? So Nose did a meta-analysis of pharmacotherapy for BPD, looking at the core traits of affective instability, et cetera. And the way this looks, NS means non-significant, plus means they found a positive result, and in parentheses are the number of studies that were addressing that particular medication class that were in the meta-analysis. So what they found were antidepressants and or mood stabilizers had some impact on affective instability, but antipsychotics did not. But antipsychotics did seem to be helpful for impulsivity and aggression, while antidepressants and mood stabilizers did not. Again, when the NICE, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, tried to look at what would be a medication for borderline personality disorder, you see just from those first two categories why you can't find something that for borderline personality disorder as an entity. Interpersonal relationships, that interestingly enough, they found three studies that were positive for the impact of antipsychotic medications, and again, antidepressants and mood stabilizers did not find anything, were not significant. Nothing for suicidality, interestingly enough, and again, antipsychotics for global functioning. What was most interesting, however, if you looked again across all the studies that they were looking at, was that 43% of the subjects in studies that involved antipsychotics left the study early, 20% of those on antidepressants, and 33% on mood stabilizers. Now, we can guess why they left the study early. We don't know that, but part of it might be because these drugs cause side effects. Because usually when people get involved in research, borderline people as well, and Mary, I think, would concur with this, they're very, very devoted and attached to the research, and they will they'll often stick with the research longer than they'll stick with therapy with me, for instance. So we have to think about this issue, particularly in pharmacologic studies, but we also need to think about why do our patients drop out. I did a study of antidepressants probably 15 years ago where we looked at psychiatrists and patients and asked them, and essentially the patients of the psychiatrist, and we asked them why they thought medications worked and why they thought medications and why they stopped medications. And in the stopping it, both the psychiatrist and the patients said that they stopped medications because of side effects. That was the first top reason for both. Patients said the second top reason was because there wasn't enough structure to their day that they could take the medications regularly. The second reason that the psychiatrist said patients stop medications had to do with the personality of the patient. So we have to address why our patients stop medications. I think we also have to buy in to the fact that it's not fun to take medications. Mostly it's not fun. I reviewed a paper many years ago that looked at medical medicines, not psychiatric medicines, and found out that something like only 78% of patients on immunosuppressants, that's drugs that you take after a transplant, so your body just doesn't decide to reject it, and that didn't even get to 80%, though psychiatric patients are often only 50% at best in their compliance with medications. So Nose et al. Said this issue that pharmacotherapy can exert a modest positive effect on the specific core traits of BPD. Given you the summary of the rest, but that basically the key word is exert a modest positive effect on the core traits. Then it was a Cochrane review for the pharmacologic intervention for people with BPD. And what was really interesting was that they found only 10 studies that they thought were worthy of entering into their meta-analyses that they thought were scientifically rigorous enough to enter into the analysis. Five of them had involved antidepressants, five antipsychotics, and two mood stabilizers. And obviously that some of the studies involved more than one class of drugs. That antidepressants did not seem to have an effect over placebo with regard to global functioning, and the scores on anger and depression may be improved, but they think that there really needs to be more work done on that. And that hostility may respond to the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, a class of drugs that we just don't seem to use very much for lots of different reasons here in the United States. That the antipsychotics, there were mixed results for improvement in global functioning. If you remember before, Nose thought that there was significant, a lot of evidence for improvement in global functioning with the antipsychotics. No advantage over placebo for anxiety, mixed and unconvincing results for depression. Less evidence here for perceptual distortions, but okay, improvement for cognitive problems, and no impact on hostility, belligerence, and impulsiveness. The mood stabilizers had no impact on global functioning and no impact on aggression, acting out, irritability, suicidality, behavioral discontrol. Other groups find that the mood stabilizers can be helpful. So what they concluded was, if offered medication, people with BPD should know that this is not based on good evidence from clinical trials. This doesn't mean it may not do considerable good, but and there's no evidence of considerable harm, though I would agree with Mary, there's plenty of evidence of considerable harm with metabolic changes in weight gain, things like that. So trial-based evidence generates as many questions as it answers. Different types of antidepressants, antipsychotics, and even mood stabilizers may be used. So I'm giving you the classes of drugs, but if there were four studies of antipsychotics, not the same antipsychotic was used in all four studies. So you've got another variable, and I'll talk about other variables that are variable in a little bit. So largely, the trials have been small, short, and poorly reported. However, any of these treatments could be of help, but it's arguable that their use, routine or not, should be from within randomized trials. So they're saying we need to do more work. The World Federation of Society of Societies of Biological Psychiatry that Mary was very involved with, and Chuck Schultz from here, who would probably be doing this talk if he wasn't out of town, so I'm happy he's out of town. And they looked at 9 trials with antidepressants, 9 with antipsychotics, and 9 with mood stabilizers. They said that there was a limited number of randomized trials. No class of psychopharmacologic agents appears to improve BPD psychopathology in general. Again, you can't treat the whole BPD with a drug. And medication suggestions will consider the dominating symptomatology of the individual patient. Again, do they have an Axis I present? Do they have the symptoms of an Axis I present, et cetera? They did find that there was some moderate evidence for cognitive perceptual symptoms, impulsive behavioral discontrol, and anger for antipsychotics. You can recall that the cognitive perceptual symptoms didn't respond in the Cochrane, I believe it was, meta-analysis. And you use antipsychotics at lower dose than in schizophrenia. And SSRIs are shown to influence, that's in quotes, emotion dysregulation that includes depression, anxiety disorder, but perhaps only when these are comorbid conditions. And then again, what do we mean when we say depression in BPD versus major depression? No evidence that they influence loneliness, emptiness, boredom. No evidence that they influence impulsive, aggressive, or other self-harm behaviors in the absence of comorbid intermittent explosive disorder. And mood stabilizers may be helpful, and topiramate's getting a big play in Europe for impulsive, aggressive behavior. So there's an urgent necessity to conduct more controlled studies of good quality. More drug trials are warranted that focus on the improvement of affective instability and we need to use safe drugs, and therefore we shouldn't be toying around with maybe even lithium, but irreversible monoamine oxidase inhibitors and the tricyclic antidepressants, and no one's ever really done ongoing treatment studies for drugs. There was a review in the Personality and Mental Health, this journal that I am one of the three co-editors. He looked at, Connor Dugan and his group looked at 25 studies for BPD. The average number of subjects in each study were 22.4 in the treatment arm and 19.3 in the control. In the olanzapine study that Mary and Chuck Schultz did, I mean, they had a lot of patients in one study, over 400, but that's the only study that's really out there that had a substantial number of people. Average length of treatment was 13.2 weeks, and you know, some antidepressants don't work until 12 to 16 weeks, or don't work in some people until 12 to 16 weeks, and they use multiple different outcome measures. So I just want to kind of jump ahead. A woman who's now at Penn State, I'm afraid to even think that Michigan is probably getting beaten up by Penn State this afternoon. You people in Minnesota understand those kinds of things. The one thing that always bothers me about Minnesota is you have that elevated basketball court, and I sit there and I'm anxious that someone's going to fall off and hurt themselves. I think about it all the time. And some people in this room know how anxious I can really be. So that we looked at we did a review and we looked at 20 studies, and we found out that 40% of those that we looked at employed antipsychotics, 7 used mood stabilizers, and 7 used antidepressants, and 1 used a benzodiazepine. And this is just the outcome measures that were used for each of those 4 dimensions across those 20 studies. So you can understand why it's hard to reach a consensus, because everybody's doing their own thing. So this summarizes the Bink study, the Nose study, the World Federation, the Connor Dugan study, and Erica Saunders and my study. And if it doesn't have parentheses, then I feel like that there was at least a decent amount of evidence. In parentheses means that there was some moderate evidence for. So it looks like medications might be useful in affective instability, the antidepressants probably, but maybe the mood stabilizing antipsychotics as well, and in aggression and impulsivity, the antipsychotics and the mood stabilizers, cognitive perceptual, the antipsychotics, and in anxiety inhibition, if there's any medications that will work there, maybe the antidepressants and the antipsychotics, but there isn't a lot of evidence. Yet we treat people, as Mary was saying this morning, we treat people with medications who have BPD, and Mary's own study after 6 years showed that 78% of borderline patients were on medications for 75% of the time in the intervening 2 years between 4 and 6 years of the follow-up, compared to 68% of the other personality disorders. 71% were still on medications at 6 years versus 54% of the others. But what's really telling is that 51% of the borderline folks were on 2 or more medications at 6 years, and 37% were on 3 or more medications for 6 years. And again, we need to really be cautious about that. And these are some medications that borderline folks have been tried on from the CLIP study. So what's a poor boy or gal to do when you're a consumer, a patient, a family member, a prescribing psychiatrist, or another therapist turning to medication for assistance? So, and before I go there, I want to take maybe a 3-minute little association here, that if you are doing therapy with folks who are borderline and you need to have them evaluated for, or if they are on medications, And I would suggest this to all of you. You need to find one or two psychiatrists that you feel like do a decent job. And I know that sometimes we're in clinics, we wind up having to have support with people that are less than ideal. I don't know how to answer or get you out of that one. But you need to have a person who you think does reasonably good psychopharmacology. You need to believe that that person believes that what you do has value, and you need to believe that what they do has value as well. And that when you're worried or they're worried, that the first thing that they do or you do is pick up the phone and you have a conversation about the patient. And I think that that's much more important than the particular medication. And it was talked about by Mary, and it was talked about by Anthony, about the being in therapy and having a certain kind of feeling about the therapy, mood about the therapy, structure to the therapy might be more important than CBT or DBT. You have to think in some holistic way, in some theoretical way, but you may choose your intervention. One may be more CBT, or one may be more DBT, or there may be even time to make a dynamic intervention, but you have to coherently have it organized. And if you have split treatment, you have to have someone that you can talk with and you know respects what you're doing. And I would guard you against an over-enthusiastic psychopharmacologist who changes medications at every moment and puts the patient on four or five medications, or the patient calls him or her and they make a medication change without talking to you. That just ain't good for the patient. I mean, that's just the bottom line. It's just not good for the patient. And that's what I would think would be almost the most important thing about medication and having someone that you do therapy with who gets medication from someone else. And I've written various forms of that. If you have the textbook of the APA, ABA textbook on personality disorders, a woman named Abby Schlesinger, who's at Pittsburgh now, and myself wrote a chapter in there, but that kind of covers in a lot more detail what I just said. But I think that that really needs to be done. With such uncertain and perhaps even conflicting information, we need models, and I just said that. So many patients are on so many medications. We can't allow the patient's chaos to lead to pharmacologic chaos. And we need models in treatment. And this is in the handout. I've got 5 minutes left, so I want to kind of move a little bit. But it all gets back to the idea of being able to choose a target behavior or symptom and trying to address that target symptom or behavior with a medication, giving the medication to the patient long enough and in the correct doses, and in the correct doses maybe higher doses of SSRIs or lower doses of atypical antipsychotics. Leave it there for a long enough time to see whether or not the medication's effective. If the medication isn't effective, then take it away before you add another. Just take it away before you add another, because as Mary said, there's no evidence that augmentation is any better than monotherapy. And if you step away from borderline and you just look at the STAR-D study with antidepressants and people with depression, that there was really no strong evidence that augmentation was any better than switching a medication or sticking, in some instances, sticking another 4 weeks with the medication. So when I write medications for somebody, I tell them, this is how I do it. You know, I'm going to be a pain in the ass, you know, I'm going to do this, but, you know, I don't want to be a year from now, there be a crisis and we have no idea whether anything ever worked because we never really were on it long enough to find out whether it worked or not. And then we're both going to not feel very good. So I ask them to put up with me. And you know what? More often than not, they do. In fact, they come in sometimes and say, you know, I wanted a different medication, but I know what you're going to say. I know that we've only been 3 weeks, you know, And you know, I just have a big grin. I just, you know, I smile at them, and they eventually smile at me, and we go on. So I just want to say a word about this idea of chemical imbalance, because people are going to say that, and over-enthusiastic psychopharmacologists are also going to believe that. If I can only just get, you know, this receptor, then I'll tweak that receptor, and I'll goose up this neurotransmitter, you know, and we'll be home. And we know a lot about neurotransmitters. We have a lot of theories about neurotransmitters and mental disease, but none of those theories yet have proved to be valid. We know what the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors do, but most people are now moving away from the idea that it's really a lack of serotonin that's the main reason why people get depressed. Not that it isn't involved, but there's something like 80 to 100 neurotransmitters, and we maybe have studied 6 or 7 in psychiatry, maybe in some little labs at various places, maybe we're up to a dozen. And we don't really know if you goose up dopamine, you know, what do you do to serotonin? So I always think of, you know, it's the cartoon character. You hit them in the stomach and their head pops up, you push their head down and their stomach pops up. So, you know, our bodies always seek homeostasis. All living organisms seek homeostasis. So we just don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Again, I'm not saying you shouldn't use medications, but I think you have to realize, well, if I can only get that damn serotonin to be the right thing, then everything will be fine. And there are plenty of psychiatrists that think that way, and not about borderline personality disorder, but they think that way about psychiatric care and treatment as well. So we have to educate people, and we have to attack the often held idea that when patients come to us and they ask us for medications or a change, and we say, well, we don't want them to change the medications at this point in time, you know, they feel like you're withholding from them like the rest of the world, that they're in pain and you're invalidating them. But that's okay. I mean, because if someone addresses it, then it can really be addressed and you can have a conversation about it. But when patients get angry at us for not giving them the medication, it goes back to that idea of people not hearing them or feeling invalidated. And I really do think that we need to address those issues. So I'll get to the... But it is easy to get to arrive at polypharmacy. You decide that the person's impulsive or angry, and you can give them an SSRI or an antipsychotic, and then they have some affective mood instability, and they're still bouncing around, so you toss in a mood stabilizer. Then they say that they're empty and depressed all the time, so why not, you know, we'll give them a little augmentation, because obviously the SSRI isn't working. And then they have an encounter with their boss, and they get paranoid. They don't want to go to work, so we'll toss in a little antipsychotic. And then, of course, you need something to sleep. Okay, but I want to say that, and I don't mean to say that I do this any better. When I admit my patients who are borderline to the unit, the first thing that the residents say to me is, huh? You told us to keep these folks on only one medication. How come this person's on 3 or 4 medications? So, you know, it's easier said than done, but you have to kind of be cognizant of that, and you have to be serious about trying to limit them and deal with whatever the stresses may be in the therapy to make that work. I have a red light in 40 seconds, so and I'm sure the therapist would appreciate this in the room. Being a psychopharmacologist doesn't protect you against transference, countertransference reactions. And if you're to the few psychiatrists who are here, and like attachments, as Anthony was saying, that opinions in these patients are made early, and their attachments to their medications can be made early, and their attachments to you as the person who has the lock on the medicine cabinet can be made early. So that once those attachments are formed, then they're not going to be easy to change. So you need to kind of, even if you're just doing psychopharmacology, you need to be aware of that. You need to be sensitive. You need to not ignore it. You need to kind of address it. And again, and if you, and the, and you're going to get classified as you're somebody else that's frustrating them and not responding to them. So we need to monitor our own feelings. We need to admit and be willing to openly discuss the difficulties that we have. And no psychopharmacologic treatment is ever purely psychopharmacological. Thanks a lot. This is a good one. Where does the boundary lie between patient and provider's responsibility for safety and compliance? Many providers prescribe medications out of concerns about legal action if they don't do enough. I had this thought when towards the end of what Barbara was saying. She's a DBT person. So one of the rules about DBT is to know your own limits. And one of the rules about DBT is to stretch your limits, which is a wonderful dialectical. But when you're dealing with a patient, you're always on the edge of what are your limits, what can you tolerate, and are you overreacting, and are you being too protective, are you being too worried, are you worried about a suit, not at the cleaners, things like that. So that... I think that the answer lies in the individual person. I think to be a good therapist, you just have to kind of tolerate uncertainty. And you also have to know, that's enough, no more. And I think we could go around the room with people who do therapy with folks at borderline and give a kind of a stress test with different clinical situations. And people will score up and down the... if you had like a 100-millimeter line scale or something. And I would be foolish to be able to say where you ought to be on that line scale. You know, I mean, Anthony talked about attachment, but I also know that you guys do take a lot of risks and let people, you know, give people almost more leeway than we do in the United States, but, you know, their liability... their tort system is somewhat different from ours. So I wish I could give you an answer, but I think you can't stay up every night worrying about your patients, but you can't sleep solidly and never, ever wake up worrying about your patients. So that's my answer. That's what we got here. You got some? Go ahead.
So this is a question about if the efficacy of a treatment does not explain why it works, is it then fair to say that DBT is more effective than others, but that the underlying theory may not be the reason why it works, especially as part of it is not substantiated by scientific data? Yeah. And I think that anybody who has developed a treatment would agree with that, and in fact, Linehan, who developed DBT, would, you know, say it's important to kind of take apart the treatment to figure out what is working, what isn't working, but it's true. It's a very great point that we don't know exactly what is the reason why it's working.
Somebody said that many of my sensitive clients have physical side effects from SSRIs. They respond well to half doses. Have I ever seen that? Yeah, I mean, I've seen that with people. I don't know what that means. Again, there are people who are looking at pharmacogenetics and think that there are people who are slow metabolizers and rapid metabolizers. So those would change different blood levels, but we also don't know with most of the SSRIs, what a blood level means. You can always find a lab that would be willing to charge you to do blood levels of SSRIs, but there isn't any data that says this blood level leads to this response, as there were with the TCAs and as the as there are with lithium. What about substance abuse in meds and alcohol and pot? What about it? No. You know, I'm sorry. That, you know, I think you have to have a realistic talk with people about medications and alcohol and everything else. I mean, I said I work in this, a day and a half a week, I work in the student health clinic, and, you know, that substance abuse on college campuses, alcohol abuse is just epidemic. You know, we have a North Campus, just an example, we have a North Campus so that, and so people take the buses, and the buses run 24 hours a day to get from one campus to the other because there are dorms there. And on Friday and Saturday nights, there's a problem because people vomit on the buses, and they have to take the buses out of service, and it's 2 a.m., and they only have two buses in service, and it costs $400 to clean a bus. And I mean, that's just a practical side effect. And you've got people who are already, if you think about BPD, and you have people who are already emotionally unstable, and if you think about we've done some PET studies looking at endogenous opioids in borderline folks with response to sadness, and you know, and you've got the whole emotion circuit. You have the prefrontal cortex up here, and then you have the limbic system, which is really the whole area of emotion, and the prefrontal cortex is probably inhibitory, and you can talk about alcohol as kind of inhibiting the inhibitory system. And if someone's going out and drinking and having, let's say, you know, a six-pack every other day, then they're always in some state of intoxication or withdrawal. And I simply say that. And I said, so, you know, here you are trying to get your emotions under control, and here you are doing everything that you can, that your brain tries to do to control your emotions, to kind of cut that circuit out. You know, it's really up to you, but you know, it seems to me that you're spinning in the wind when that's going on. So you have to really decide what it is that you want to do. It isn't that you can't go and have a drink or even two drinks, but, you know, I mean, and six drinks often is the floor for people because people can put down, you know, 12 drinks. I mean, I hear about it, and I get up and stumble just hearing about it, let alone. So I think you just have to address people that, you know, I'm happy to do this. If you want to continue to use drugs, you know it isn't good, and it's not going to allow us to really understand what the psychiatric medications that are going to do. But it's, you know, it's really up to you. I can't follow you around and do spot urines every 3 hours. I mean, I just can't do that. So you have to decide. There is a question here. Please talk about omega-3 fatty acids and their effectiveness in managing symptoms of BPD. I can answer that question? Oh, come on. Well, I think if I remember correctly, that when Mary and Francis did the study, I mean, they found it was effective for some emotional instability and the depression. Do I have that right? And you know, omega-3s have been shown to be helpful for people who have depression. Let's leave BPD aside. So the role of omega-3s in BPD or in depression or in emotion dysregulation is really, I think, just beginning. The problem with that is it has no champion because there's no pharmaceutical company that's going to make a lot of money on, you know, you're going to Whole Foods and buying, or going to Walgreens or wherever else and buying omega-3. And the one company that was really making really high-grade one is out of business. So until somebody can figure out that they can make a profit or get the federal government to buy them out if they don't make a profit, then, you know, then, I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't know how that will work. But, it, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that omega-3s can be helpful. Particularly with respect to mood, but I don't know how much work's being done. Do you? How much work's being done on omega-3 across the board?
Some in bipolar.
But what they found coincides with what's being found in the mood disorders. So, you know, I think someone will do it. But again, I mean, the real problem would be right now, if nobody's making quality grade medicine, then where are you going to get it? And you can go to Walgreens and get it, but there's nobody's looking at what the bioavailability of the bottle you buy from Walgreens today and the bottle you buy from Walgreens tomorrow.